Campus FM presents The Probe, produced and presented by Monique Chambers. Welcome to this week's edition of The Probe with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week, Rachel Radmilli, who has a Master's in Anthropology and works as an Applied Anthropologist here at the University of Malta. So, what does an Applied Anthropologist do?
Well, in a sense, my anthropological background is quite interesting in the sense that it brings together my formation, my background in anthropology, which is formally referred to as a kind of comparative study of societies, but which allows us to also study different situations at home. And it helps me also combine my work with the Faculty of Economics in the Department of Management, where I've had this opportunity to be able to study organizations as part of my doctoral research, which are wine producing or involved in the wine production industry.
So you're doing a study on the production of wine?
The production of wine in Malta,
More
specifically.
Okay.
And it's been quite an interesting journey in the sense that I've had a chance to look also through certain archival research and had some time to work as well at Biblioteca Nazionale in Valletta. That beautiful building. Yes. Quite a pleasure to actually just sit in, you know, and let alone be able to do some research over there. And I've managed to go find several records, you know, the old agricultural reports, especially when we were part of the British, as a part of a British colony, for example. Which were quite detailed and actually had specific sections, I came to find out, dedicated to the wine sector in Malta specifically, because they were trying to encourage a change in some of the agricultural practices in Malta by planting specifically grapes for winemaking as opposed to table grapes, for example. And that combined with several interviews and working with all the different companies in Malta which are involved in winemaking, some of the big old companies we're more familiar with, for example, companies like Marsovin, Delicata, Coleiro, Dacutros, these old companies, for example, some of which aren't even working anymore in wine. But I've also had a fantastic opportunity to work with some of the younger companies which are just starting up or have been starting up for the past maybe 10, 12 years, taking advantage perhaps of the sort of like economic climate which comes about through our being part of the European Union as well, which gave some people, smaller operators, an opportunity to set up.
Okay, so how long has the wine history been in Malta?
There are traces which go back into the archaeological remains, which possibly predated the Roman period, actually.
Okay.
Some findings located in Zeytun, which have just been explored by people like Dr. Vella from the Archaeology and Classics Department, are showing evidence for wine trenches, which actually predate the foundations for the Roman villa that's located right in the school of Zeytun.
That's fantastic.
So it's quite interesting that it goes back so far.
And so what does your research entail? Is it just reading? Is there some...
No. There is the archival research, the, you know, sifting through all the records and the archives and things like that. But the more important part is actually visiting several locations. I've had several opportunities to go to the different companies, the different wineries and the different vineyards as well. Because maybe one thing that's really changed in winemaking in Malta over the past 20 years, 30 years, is that there's been much more heavy investment at vineyard level. In the past, we used to think about places like Marsovin and Delicata, who are the heavyweights in a way of winemaking in Malta, but who are focused largely on the actual wine pressing. There weren't so many opportunities throughout the 70s and 80s, for example, for them to grow their own grapes. But through visiting these companies and visiting the smaller companies at so many different levels of their operation and speaking to the different stakeholders involved, you start picking different bits of information which you can slowly start collecting together to create this story of winemaking in Malta. And it also involves not only the people who are specifically involved in wine production in the companies themselves, but it also involves, for example, different stakeholders at different levels, say, for example, the regulators at government level, the specialists, the enologists, people who go around advising different companies, people who are really key in giving specialist information to smaller companies, companies which eventually also became game changers as well and have contributed together with the bigger companies as well to the improvement of the Maltese wine product as well nowadays.
So what did you mean by game changers? What's happened in the industry recently then that has put us on the map suddenly, it feels?
Yes, it's not only just the feeling, it really is something which is happening in real time, something quite tangible, because the quality of Maltese wine has really been going from strength to strength. One of the game changers, in a sense, possibly are the people behind Meridiana Winery, because in the 90s they had actually set up the first so-called boutique winery that we can actually refer to as a boutique winery nowadays. Whilst before estate wineries did exist, say for example in the very early 1900s you had people involved in Palazzo Gomerino and Rabat, for example, who had sort of their own estates and they invested in their own winemaking. But in the 1990s, Meridiana were the first group of people involving about three specialists, or three people who were keen to set up this winery, who started off the winery in Ta'ali. And they, in a sense, went pretty much against the grain. Very few people actually believed that they would actually succeed, but thanks a little bit of hard-headedness on their part, perhaps, and perseverance, you should say, and also investment in the right kind of specialist advice and the right technology as well, including laser technology, for example, to plant all their vines in extremely straight lines.
Wow.
They really did up the game. And that got people thinking, and it created a certain amount of competition, even for the larger companies, perhaps, to start, you know, focusing on the creation of quality wines in Malta as well.
So you're going down to the level of detail you mentioned there about the straight lines of
yes.
the vine. You're actually going down to that level of detail to see what difference...
Not really focusing on the science behind winemaking. I am focusing more on the companies themselves and the socio-political environment in which they're existing, perhaps. So the politics that affects winemaking, the context in which these companies are setting up. However, these little finer details, these innuendos, if you like, come up in the stories that people tell. When they're speaking about how they set up their wineries, for example, the personal stories that come in, you know, the things which perhaps even fascinated some of the business minds behind the creation of these companies, when they saw what kind of technology existed and what they could actually use and operate nowadays to help them improve their situation, they're all parts of the stories which do come into their narrative, if you like.
So is Malta mimicking a particular country or a particular region for its winemaking, or is it different families and different houses taking different influences?
Influences with neighbouring countries always do exist to a certain extent. Funnily enough, the Maltese wine industry as it stands today is relatively new, but in actual fact we're really at the heart of the old wine territories. We've always looked towards our Italian neighbours for, you know, quality in terms of their gastronomic traditions. So whether it's food, whether it's wine, beverage, we always look towards the Italians. And there is scope for a lot of collaboration with Italy on many different levels. But the French were also the ones who were always the pioneers when it came to winemaking. So even when it comes to legislation, for example, and the creation of certain standards like the DOK standards, which is the Non Attività Origine Controllata, so it's a DOC in English, or the AOC in French. But the Italian influence is there because, one, there have been projects even with the University of Malta, for example, collaborating with Sicily and other smaller islands around Sicily, like Linosa and Pantelleria, to compare the different the territories or the environments and how, you know, sort of the vineyards are affected by the soils, for example, or the climate, the terroir. But you also have, for instance, the importation of certain rootstocks, which have done very well in Italy and Sicily in similar climates to ours. So, for example, the Nero d'Avola grape is actually used very often in winemaking in Malta. The only thing is that with European legislation, we can't refer to that wine as Nero d'Avola because it's connected to a place.
So what would we call it?
Many companies here are referring to it as the Siracusan. There is the Syracuse connection, which is where it's from, but it's been given a different name because legally speaking, we can't really refer to it as Nero d'Avola.
So now these sort of new wine families, per se,
yes.
Are they receiving their own marketing attention and people understanding where they're coming from, or is this like a new wine that people are thinking, wow, I like this, and not understanding the root of it, so to speak?
It's nice that you're asking this because each wine family, as you call them, which isn't a bad way of referring to it, because usually they are families, they're very small undertakings, even one man shows sometimes, are all using different strategies. So if at the moment there are, for example, about six or seven who are doing really well and they're really coming of age and producing good wine, they're all marketing their wine in very, very different ways. Some organize wine tastings, for example, and say supply a couple of key restaurants in Malta because they're going for quality and targeting quality restaurants. They don't even go through any particular agents or anything like that. They definitely, the smaller ones especially, do not go through the supermarket because they're not producing for the masses. Even the volume that they produce is quite low. You have some, for example, who've done well through certain sites like TripAdvisor. There's one particular winery in Gozo, which is a very small enterprise, but they're producing very interesting wines that have won quite a few awards, even on an international level, in international competitions.
Okay.
They are really doing well by using all these tourist websites like TripAdvisor to gain recognition with the wider public, for example. And word is going around even electronically on their wines, and people are specifically and deliberately looking for these niche wines because they're so rare.
Do you find the Maltese are drinking more Maltese wine?
The attitude is changing because in the past we used to have a tendency to look down on Maltese wine, okay? Our generation especially, okay, people who are, shall we say, 30 plus.
You're very kind.
I try to be very kind. You know, we used to have this stigma attached to Maltese wine. We used to refer to it as, you know, and in fact, there are many jokes in a sense, where people often used to say that, you know, truckloads of sugar would go into, you know, from one side of the company. But in actual fact, that wasn't really a fair critique because also many of these companies also used to produce soft drinks or, for example, sugar drinks and things like that. So while there might be some truth, it wasn't necessarily associated with wine. But at the time, the political climate was different. They also had their own difficulties. They couldn't import, for example, grapes from abroad because of the control of importation. And they had no competition. So obviously the quality of wine at the time went down and they got stuck to a certain extent with some reputations perhaps. But things today really have changed. And even the older generations are starting to realize that maybe we should start trying out the Maltese products because really and truly we have a perfect terroir in Malta for the creating of good quality wines. And we have some people who are really in it just for the passion. Not necessarily to make money out of the industry itself.
So you mentioned there that we have the perfect terroir. Does that work for both reds and whites?
Nowadays, we could say that it works for whites as well, for the simple reason that there is the technology now to help out. With good refrigeration systems, the temperatures could be controlled scientifically and quite precisely. So that really helps in the production of good quality white wine as well.
So is Malta now able to export more wines? We know there's like some international awards coming out, like you said, these Gozerton wines. Why are we winning awards and where are we exporting to?
There have been several attempts to export wine and go international. Delicata, for instance, had carried out an interesting experiment even with a large British supermarket chain. And in actual fact, the supermarket chain really did like their wines and they did want to try and encourage them to go further with it. But the company then decided to keep to its production because otherwise they would have had to invest to be able to produce the kind of volume required by Asda. And in a sense, being a small industry in a small country, volume is our strength and our weakness at the same time. So we are winning awards partly because the people involved, both in the big companies and even in the smaller wineries, are really now focusing on the quality and on trying to create something different. And each different company is creating something different compared to their competitors or their rivals, if you like. So that's created something quite unique, also because the volumes are so small. You have wineries producing maybe 30,000, 40,000 bottles at most. So in a sense, there is this demand, especially on an international level, by certain connoisseurs, for example, even abroad, who seek out these rare wines. And places like Malta do provide for that kind of market, where you have a few people who are willing to buy the wine, not necessarily also look at the wine at the price tag, because the price tag, for example, compared to other countries abroad, is quite hefty sometimes, and this is why they wouldn't even sell properly on the supermarket level. But there's that something unique, where you know that it's this one small company, say, in Attard, in Arp, in Zeytun, which is produced by people who are very often have their own independent careers, medical practitioners, people who have their own companies, different people, teachers as well, people working in agriturismo. But they have this winemaking hobby, if you like, which really brings in their passion in a sense that it also focuses on them having a certain type of character as well. Most of them are men. There are a few women who work in supportive roles, okay, in these companies, usually the wives of many of these men who are involved in the winemaking process. But their passion and their exacting nature for this hobby, you know, this perfectionist approach to winemaking, has led to the production of some interesting wines that are becoming quite desirable abroad as well.
So, if you've just joined us, you're listening to The Probe with Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Rachel Radmilly, and we're talking about the anthropology of local wines. So the popularity of Maltese wine, sort of improving its image locally, that's going to mean training waiters in restaurants as well to actually help customers decide, because tourists, whenever we have tourists, we always choose a Maltese wine and we pretty much stick to the same ones that you knew from last time. But is there an education process that's being rolled out?
You do have certain courses for sommeliers, in fact, where people are specialized in wine tasting and in choosing the right wines for the right occasion and even to match the right kinds of foods, if you like. But interestingly, something you've hinted at is that, you know, you said that we like to choose the wines we know. There's this element of trust, in a sense, okay, where the consumer very often is sometimes afraid to buy certain bottles of wine in case something might be wrong with that bottle of wine once you open it. In a sense, it's a bit of a blind thing, you know, where you're going into a bottle of wine and you want to obviously impress your guests and you want to do something good, or even give a bottle of wine as a gift, for example, if you're going to a party or something. And given this, you know, perhaps past story, reputation is very important in the wine industry. So marketing, in a sense, or getting people to trust the wineries that are producing wine in Malta is one of the hardest challenges that there are. But people are becoming more adventurous, they're trying things, and in a sense, the consumer perhaps also needs to trust themselves as well, because the important thing at the end of the day, although we do judge a bottle of wine by the label, perhaps, we all go through the label details, we all try and see whether we like the style and the design of the front label, for example. But in actual fact, you also need to trust your own palate, your own sense of taste. Because if there's a wine you like, it doesn't really matter whether it's a cheap wine, an expensive wine, whatever. As long as you like the taste of that wine, then, you know, we need to trust our own sense of taste as well.
And do you think, it might be taking a side route, but if we actually didn't say certain wines were from Malta, and if we said they were from Sicily and gave them as tastings, people would have a different perception of them?
We do tend to give a certain extra status kind of thing to foreign wines, yes. We do tend to look up towards foreign wines. But in actual fact, some of the Maltese wines compare extremely well to foreign wines as well.
And are you doing any comparisons with other countries for your research?
For my research itself, no. However, I have had the chance to travel around different countries. Italy is really on our doorstep, so I've had many chances, using my research as an excuse perhaps, to visit different wineries. And also in Argentina itself, because I've had the chance to visit Argentina a few times. Okay. I've been to Mendoza. And you always get to go around and travel different wineries, and small ones and large ones, and the large ones are sometimes even the size of the whole of the Maltese Islands. I mean, when talking about size, you know, it's a completely different scale over there. But it's nice to also compare the New World wines with the Old World wines as well, given this different terroir, this different climate that there is that is producing these wines.
So in terms of our comparison into our ranges of grapes, how do we compare with a Malbec, for example? Is there something that's grown locally that can compare
there
to the
is,
latest trends?
There is. There are certain red wines that are coming out on the market. For example, there's the San Nicolau Winery in Zeytun, speaking about Zeytun again, which is run actually by a pediatric surgeon. It's his passion, okay, in a sense. And he has this winery on an old family estate, which has a chapel called San Nicolau, hence the name of the estate itself, the winery. And he has some red wines that are very strong, full-bodied red wines over there, kind of thing. And it's worth investing in at least one bottle. You have to try at least a bottle once in your life, kind of thing, because they do compare nicely with the New World Malbecs, for example, or even the stronger red wines.
And so this research, what is actually going to happen to it once you've finished?
As part of the process, I will be publishing a monograph. So the old traditional anthropological kind of publication, which will be part of my completion of this work. And that's what I'm doing at the moment. So most of my work right now is out of the field, out of the companies, out of the vineyards, and I'm at home on the computer writing up. And hopefully that will then also provide information, if it comes out, maybe even as something a little bit more fanciful in a sense, to be able to disseminate some of this information to the broader public, to make people aware that we have something really and truly to be proud of.
Yeah, I think it'd be lovely to have a series of articles or something that's
well,
talking about different wines and doing comparisons.
Yes.
And even wine tastings on Maltese wines.
Many companies already do that.
But they just do their individual.
They do their individual.
I think it'd be nice to do a...
Yes. But in a sense, I mean, if there's one appeal over here which I'd like to make, it's that people should try Maltese wines, because the wineries are also investing in the specialist knowledge as well. They're not just hobbyists who are doing things in a totally amateur way and just, you know, hit and miss kind of situation. There are people who are doing things on a, you know, relatively professional level as well, bringing in the specialists, bringing in the viticulturalists, the enologists, big words I know, but they are the specialists who could really give the right advice to these winemakers to create a quality product.
And so the research, again, will that be disseminated through to the people that you've spoken to so they can see everything
they are
happening?
Welcome to use as much of this information as they want as well, because they've given me all the information themselves. And I thought it might be interesting to also point out that I'm actually reading for my PhD in Amsterdam with the Vrije University in Amsterdam, and there's a lot of interest over there in this kind of work, you know. So it's a Mediterranean study, but it's also, you know, so there's this curiosity aspect to it where, you know, the Dutch are quite interested in trying out all these niche wines as well.
Didn't they buy our tomatoes already, or potatoes?
The potatoes, the Maltese potatoes,
yes. Perhaps we could have a new industry.
A sideline, exactly. We're working on parallel lines, if you wish.
Our wines.
Yes.
So after studying wines, obviously you're pretty knowledgeable now about local wine production. Do you prefer Maltese wines now? Is that something you choose, or is it now it feels like work?
Well, yes, sometimes it does feel like work. And in fact, I often joke with friends of mine that, you know, so they say, okay, so which wines would you choose? And I say, I normally choose a whiskey. but that's not really fair on the industry itself, because in actual fact, I've enjoyed experimenting. And sometimes sort of when you go to different wineries, it's a nice excuse to say, listen, I'd like to buy a box of wine for a party. And it gets people talking as well, you know, and I do get to actually enjoy that sort of wine. It's not really a kind of cheating technique to get hold of information, but it's, you know, so once you do collect a certain amount of wine as well, it's nice to enjoy it with friends, give it as gifts. For example, there's also another company producing the first equivalent of port, if you like, which is referred to as a fortified wine, because we can't call it port. So even, you know, people are, the companies are becoming adventurous in that respect as well. But then it's also nice to compare with other wines. For example, I've been given certain gifts, such as the Primitivo, for example, which is really nice, and, you know, different wines from neighboring areas. So it's nice to compare and, you know, actually, well, it's a subjective comparison because it's my own sense of taste, but it's nice to compare with what's happening abroad, and it's enjoyable in different contexts as well.
So after studying wine and tasting all of these wines for this study, have you got plans to do research on other aspects of food? Do you need any help?
Help is always welcome. You have to join the queue, I'm afraid. Especially when it came to the wine. In actual fact, maybe one thing that's a bit of a spin-off from this research, and also combined with some of my teaching over here at university, there is a course which I teach on sustainable enterprise.
Okay.
And that is perhaps an area which I wish to look into a little bit further, because it's quite interesting, especially when you look at small companies and young people who are involved in this kind of business, who are really working, again, with a certain passion, trying to change the world one step at a time with their own sense of values and passions and things. And for this particular course, for example, I take my students around different companies and different entities, whether they're public or volunteer or even small private companies like Grossi Hopper, for example. We always end up having lunch over there with the students. So food comes into it all the time.
But no wine.
Well, no wine over there. No, it's true. We need to do something about that, perhaps, although lunch is quite early for wine. And it's nice to hear the story of these people who are using business as a way to do good in the world. Somehow we're always hearing about business being the evildoers, the big baddies of society, you know, the ones who are ruining our environment and doing all sorts of horrible things. But there are some small businesses who are going into business with a certain frame of mind, with a certain philosophy, a certain ethical background, if you like. And they're continuing with this passion to try and do good in society. Just to give one example from Grossi Hopper, for example, the way she used to import all these takeaway containers, for example, which were all biodegradable, so they wouldn't really ruin the environment with more plastic being thrown out. little things which perhaps could be worth studying a little bit further, try and encourage more people to do the same thing.
And do you think there's any synergy between the two, sort of a sustainable winery?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Perhaps that there could be something.
It's interesting that you do have certain wineries who are trying to come out of the whole organic approach to wine and stuff like that. In truth, most all wineries and all vineyards have this connection to the environment and connection to nature. And there have been certain projects which have also dwelt on this concept, if you like. Because what's interesting about Malta is that come late spring, early summer, our environment starts turning brown. It dries up, everything dries up, and everything becomes really hot and just dusty and whatever. But in actual fact, what's fascinating about grapes is that the vines remain green throughout summer. It's only in autumn that they start turning mm-hmm. orange and drying up. So by planting more vineyards, by planting more grapes, we're actually helping our environment take on a bit of a greener look, something which we tend to look upon more positively.
So if there are any small holders out there or somebody who has a bit of a passion and wants to start this hobby, is there areas of Malta where they should be looking? Is there, you know, where the most fertile land is for wine growing? It sounds like it is an opportunity for people to get into the industry. It's quite an exciting time.
It's interesting you ask that because really and truly, all of Malta has its potential and characteristics. And Malta, as such, for agricultural purposes, is divided pretty much into two regions. There's Goldsu and there's Malta. And I mentioned earlier on that Malta is a perfect terroir because we have the right sunshine, we have the right hours of sunshine, and so on and so forth. However, any area of Malta really would be good because our weak spot in the Maltese Islands is the water. But we are one of the few places in the European Union that is actually allowed to irrigate our vines okay. in summer. Most other countries cannot irrigate. So really and truly, any part of the islands is perfect for growing wine, well, growing grapes for winemaking, to be exact.
A great line to end on. So thank you for listening. You've been listening to myself, Monique Chambers, and Rachel Admidley, who's an applied anthropologist here studying wine in the Maltese Islands. And that's this week's edition of The Probe. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have just listened to The Probe, produced and presented by Monique Chambers.